This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for tuning in today. We all recognize this sound. It's a healthy heart at work. But heart disease remains a leading cause of death for men and women across the country, and increasingly more people are suffering from heart failure. But only a tiny fraction of patients who could benefit from a heart transplant each year receive one, and heart failure has an economic impact. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention estimates the cost of health care services, medications, and lost productivity at more than $34 billion every year. In the Milwaukee area, Frederick Hospital and the Medical College of Wisconsin have a robust program to treat patients at all points on the heart failure spectrum. One area doctor who works with heart failure patients every day is Claudius Marr. He's an advanced heart failure cardiologist at Frederick and the Medical College. He tells Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce that heart failure is an overlooked public health concern.
I think it's unfortunately somewhat underappreciated. Anywhere from 5 to 7 million people in the United States suffer from heart failure. And across that continuum, almost 60% of patients will die from that disease process within 5 years.
So what are some of the contributing factors here?
So depending on the age, different things lead to patients developing heart failure. So in younger patients, sometimes untreated long-standing high blood pressure. In older patients, coronary artery disease, blockages to the heart arteries will cause the heart to weaken over time. It's more than patients with lung cancer, prostate cancer, HIV, and AIDS combined passing away from heart failure every year.
Do most patients recognize these symptoms, or is it really just that they're experiencing the symptoms of those contributing factors and then they find out, wow, it's caused this heart failure?
For the most part, unfortunately, there are no specific symptoms to heart failure. Some patients develop fluid retention. Other patients just experience fatigue, shortness of breath, fairly vague symptoms that a lot of times go unchecked for long periods of time.
Does that make it hard for doctors to pick up on this issue before it becomes as serious as it can be?
Thankfully, there are very effective testing and screening methods, anywhere from routine blood tests to specialized blood tests that are associated with heart failure to electrocardiograms, EKGs, echocardiograms, ultrasounds of the heart that look at squeezing function, and that's how we're able to diagnose patients. The problem is that along that continuum, oftentimes patients that would have been able to be managed by addressing their risk factors for developing heart failure end up not getting diagnosed until later when they're having symptoms.
Explain that continuum a little bit more. I think when people hear heart failure, they immediately think, oh my gosh, I'm dying right now.
So the American Heart Association and the American College of Cardiology stage heart failure from stage A, which is no evidence of structural heart disease, but at risk for developing heart failure, to stage B, which is some evidence of damage to the heart, meaning enlargement or thickening of the walls, but patients never had symptoms, to stage C, which is the classic, what we think of as heart failure, patients who are symptomatic and have structurally abnormal hearts, all the way to stage D, which is patients that have advanced heart failure that can't be managed with conventional medications alone. So ideally, we would pick up patients at stage A, treat their risk factors aggressively, and delay or avoid entirely them progressing to develop symptomatic heart failure many years later.
What happens to the body as it goes along this continuum if it hasn't been picked up in those early stages and over time it just progresses?
So eventually the heart gets to the point where it can't meet the body's demands for either oxygen or nutrients. And that's when patients become symptomatic and experience symptoms like shortness of breath, fatigue, the inability to engage in activities of normal daily living, climbing stairs, walking, exercising, those kinds of things. But at that point, the prognostic part of it means that patients tend to do not as well as they could had they been picked up earlier on. So unfortunately, the symptoms happen relatively late, And when they do happen, the disease course is much worse than if we picked it up earlier.
What do you do if you are able to catch it early on? What is the treatment and what kind of changes do the patients have to make to their lives?
So the first thing we try to do is to figure out the cause of heart failure. So if high blood pressure contributes to it, we identify that and we treat the blood pressure aggressively. If cholesterol, diabetes, sleep apnea, those kinds of things play into it, we address those and we treat them. And then we have very effective medications that are designed to help with the process of strengthening the heart and reversing some of the damage.
Is it possible to stop heart failure once that process begins?
Once patients are symptomatic from heart failure, meaning they have structural changes to the heart where the heart is weaker or stiffer or thicker, and they have symptoms, usually it's impossible to completely reverse it, but a lot of times we can improve it with medications. About a third of patients get much better with conventional medical therapy. A third don't improve much structurally, but feel much better and do well long term. And another third gets worse over time and needs specialized interventions.
Well, tell us then about the treatments that are available for patients who unfortunately have gone to the advanced heart failure stage.
There are about 5% of patients of the total heart failure pool who progress to what we would call advanced heart failure. So essentially what advanced heart failure means is you must have been treated for heart failure with the best available therapies, medications, diuretics, pacemakers, and still have symptoms or continue to deteriorate. So typically those are patients who are unable to walk at least a block or climb a flight of stairs without feeling short of breath or fatigued, at rest, or with minimal exertion, and that's what we would consider advanced heart failure.
What is the option at that point?
So really there's a limited number of things available. For the patients that are candidates for that, there's heart transplantation. And heart transplantation is very effective as a therapy, but the problem with it is it's limited by the donor pool. So there's about 150 to 200,000 patients in the United States who would theoretically be in need of a heart transplant. The problem is that there's only about 2,200 donor hearts available every year. The second option for patients, either as a bridge to a heart transplant or as a therapy alone, is something called a ventricular assist device or a surgically implanted blood pump.
Now, explain what that is.
So essentially, these are mechanical devices that take over for the failing left ventricle and support normal blood flow to the rest of the body. So they've come a long way since their inception. The first generation was somewhat cumbersome and not all that mechanically reliable. The second and third generation devices are much better, to the point where 90% of our patients at our institution are alive and well a year after they undergo that surgery.
You mentioned that it serves as a bridge until a heart becomes available. How long, then, can a patient traditionally expect to be on this VAD, I think it's called?
Mm-hmm. So, unfortunately, the wait time for a heart transplant is increasing, ever increasing, across the United States and in all developing countries because the donor pool is getting smaller and the medical therapies have resulted in the unintended consequence of older patients, more patients that are older with more heart failure. As medical therapy has improved, patients are surviving their heart attacks, their cardiac arrests, they have bypass surgery, angioplasty, stents, pacemakers, and things that 20 years ago would have been fatal, now patients are surviving. So it's interesting in the sense that that then leads to more heart failure 10, 15 years down the line. It also makes patients poorer transplant candidates. So somebody who would have been a great transplant candidate when they were in their mid-40s or 50s now is really pushing it when they're reaching the age of 65, 70. And so the wait time for a heart transplant is about 18 months. If you take patients who have end-stage heart failure and require intravenous medications to support their heart, their expected survival is very, very short. Untreated, most patients pass away within really weeks to months. So the ventricular assist device is a means of essentially optimizing patients for the heart transplant and allowing us to have them wait for that donor heart becoming available. So we know that 90% of patients are alive 1 year later, and we know that close to 90% of patients are successfully bridged to a heart transplant. As the wait times increase and the devices get better, we're not exactly sure how long somebody that we implant here today is going to live, because unfortunately those studies haven't been done yet. But the devices are to the level where they can, at least on a bench, run for very long periods of time, years. The trade-off to the device is our patients are no longer in heart failure, and they actually feel, for the most part, very well. So if you look at how they felt when they had decompensated heart failure, not able to do anything, not able to really live, to the point now where most patients with a ventricular assist device in our hands are able to do anything and everything with the exception of contact sports and submerging themselves in water, because water and electricity are a bad combination.
What do these devices look like? I mean, it sounds like the patients don't necessarily have to be staying in the hospital while they have these devices.
Yeah, so the devices themselves are very small. They're what's called continuous flow devices. So they pump blood continuously from the left ventricle into the ascending aorta and the big artery in the body. And they're actually very small, so they're miniaturized to the point where we can use them even in small adults and sometimes in children. The battery pack itself, the part that's outside of the body, is probably about the same size as your tape recorder. The part that's implanted into the heart for the third generation device sits directly on top of the heart, so it doesn't require a pump pocket or a major kind of space in the body, which is actually very small. So they would easily fit into the palm of your hand, the entire device.
As the devices are being able to help more patients, bridging that gap as the wait times are increasing, are we going to see a switch to where the focus will be on the devices versus having more people become donors?
So sadly, that switch is already happening. The most recent article published about this was from our colleagues out of New York, and what they showed was that a few years ago, over half of patients would get routinely transplanted after their ventricular assist device was implanted. Now that number has dropped to about less than 20%, and what that means essentially is that the wait times are increasing. Patients are still getting transplanted successfully. Thankfully, no one is dying because of that, but the way patients get transplanted, because the devices have gotten so good, means that a lot more patients essentially have to wait a longer period of time. And the problem with heart transplantation is that even though it's the gold standard, it's not perfect. So the median survival across the United States after a heart transplant is about 15 years. 15 years may seem like a long time when you're 66 years old, but if you're 33 years old and have heart failure from chemotherapy or from an autoimmune disease and have young children, all of a sudden those 15 years become a very short period of time. So ultimately, we hope that we are able to improve the devices to the point where they're fully implantable, meaning they don't have an outside battery supply, and reduce the risk of infection that way, and at the same time provide transplantation for patients that truly benefit from it the most, because we don't see the organ donor pool getting any bigger.
How long have you been practicing, and what is it like for you to see this evolution of these devices and how they're helping patients today?
So I graduated from medical school in 2004. And it's interesting, when I finished my specialty, which what I do today is I'm a board-certified advanced heart failure and transplant cardiologist, that didn't even exist. So I saw the first generation of pulsatile devices that essentially were large, looked like something out of a hardware store, to the continuous flow devices that were kind of like a propeller mechanism on a jet ski and were technologically much improved, to now to the point where we have these devices that are coming out that are yet smaller and yet more mechanically reliable. So it's a very rapidly evolving field, and it requires a specialized skill set that typically you need a large academic medical center for.
Tell me about the program here between Frederick and the Medical College, and how many patients are you treating in this kind of advanced heart failure category?
So we have about 300-something advanced heart failure patients that we currently manage. And we do a ventricular assist device implantation pretty much every week or every other week at this point. We have a cohort of post-transplant patients that we follow after their heart transplant. And so it's plenty to keep us busy. We have a phenomenal multidisciplinary team that consists of heart failure cardiologists, cardiac surgeons, coordinators, nurses, social workers, psychologists, engineers, perfusionists. So it's a very, very large team that essentially practices to have those patients afford the best possible outcome.
What would you like listeners to know about heart failure, their risks for heart failure, and the treatments available?
So I think it's important to routinely follow up with primary care physicians to undergo screening for things like high blood pressure, diabetes, high cholesterol, sleep disordered breathing, sleep apnea, things like that, to avoid developing heart failure to begin with. And then when patients do develop symptoms, to seek medical attention in a timely fashion. And for those patients that develop symptoms despite all of our best efforts, to then consider being seen in an advanced heart failure program to have the best possible outcome.
Well, Dr. Claudius Marr, thank you so much for speaking with us on Lake Effect.
It was my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Dr. Claudius Marr is an advanced heart failure specialist at Frederick Hospital and the Medical College of Wisconsin. There's a link to more information from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Keep listening. When we return, we'll talk about some of the many accents and dialects that shape how we talk in Wisconsin and learn how Wisconsin talk sounds different from what we'd hear anywhere else in the country. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio.